From Arizona to New York, Mississippi to Montana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Israel has suffered a devastating terrorist attack. What are the repercussions and what might happen next? Stephen Simon from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is here to discuss. Under the Capitol Dome and around the country, it's been a busy week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The federal government is without a budget and operating under a continuing resolution until November 15th. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Veronique DeRugge of the Mercatus Center about what must be done to bring spending under control. And move over basketball. Volleyball is rapidly rising as the most popular women's college sport. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Hamas unleashed a historic terrorist attack on Israel that has left thousands dead and wounded, including Americans. Here with an overview of the situation in the Mideast is Stephen Simon. He is a senior research analyst at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a professor at the University of Washington. He is also author of the book, Grand Delusions, The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. Stephen, welcome to American Radio Journal. Stephen, let's talk for a minute about the situation in the Mideast, particularly relative to Israel and the Palestinians, as it existed before these terrorist attacks occurred last weekend. What was the climate there?
The climate between Israel and the Palestinians was not good. The Israeli coalition that's ruling Israel now was taking a very tough and uncompromising position toward the Palestinians in the West Bank, which is part of the occupied territories that Israel took in 1967 in a big war that was fought at that time. And the Palestinians in Gaza were penned up. There are about 2 million people in Gaza in an area that's the size, let's say double the size of Manhattan. It's not very large, a lot of people crammed in there. And the Israelis controlled what went in and what came out of Gaza. And this had resulted in a number of conflicts ever since the Israelis actually withdrew their settlements from Gaza in 2005. There have been periodic flare-ups. These have been very violent. They've entailed rocket attacks on Israel and severe bombing raids against Gaza, and on one occasion, at least, the entry of Israeli ground forces into Gaza. The last round, which took place a couple of years ago, lasted for 51 days and involved a lot of destruction. What we're seeing now is the latest round. More broadly, in the Middle East, it's been the age of Aquarius. The Saudis have emerged as the great power in the Middle East, replacing others that have preceded it in that role. And the U.S. was seeking kind of a complicated diplomatic arrangement as a result of this Age of Aquarius, in which the United States would sign a defense treaty with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis, in turn, would normalize relations with Israel. So you'd have essentially a diplomatic pact of some kind between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which people regarded as quite a historical benchmark, you know, something that was really important. And that was part of the background, it is thought, to this current outbreak of violence between Hamas in Gaza and the Israelis, because Palestinians thought that the pending agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia would leave Palestinians in the dust. And so they were strongly motivated to disrupt this deal. And they might well have done so. We won't know until after the shooting stops and we get a sense of where the Saudis are on this.
Let's talk here for a second. This seemed to take pretty much everybody by surprise. Certainly, it appeared to be a surprise to the Israelis. How were they able to put together such a massive, complex operation and do so essentially under the radar?
There are a few moving parts here. One, of course, is that the Palestinians in Gaza, the Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad, the two groups behind this, have become very good at operational security, which is just military talk for being able to keep a secret. And so that's one important factor. The second is that this might not have actually been in preparation for months. This operation waged by Hamas might well have been spring-loaded, which is to say it was ready to go at the moment that Hamas deemed most favorable to launch it. The implication there is that there might not have been much to hear in the time leading up to the launch of the Hamas attack. The third factor is that Israeli intelligence assets, just like American intelligence assets or those of any country, they're not unlimited. You have to make choices. You have to prioritize what intelligence you're going to try to collect and what kind of an effort you're going to make to collect it. The Israelis have been focused on Iran, of course, but also on events in the West Bank. There's been a lot of unrest in the West Bank. I think it's also possible that Israel, therefore, was simply looking in a different direction and not looking as closely as it might have done toward Gaza, simply because Gaza was deprioritized owing to limitations on the assets the Israelis had to devote to intelligence collection. There are a number of reasons for this surprise that the Israelis experienced, quite tragically. But none of these factors are in themselves a big surprise.
Taking a look at what has historically happened after attacks, after flare-ups of this sort have occurred, can we learn anything from that as to where we might go to from here? Or is it at this point anybody's guess?
Certainly at this point, it's anybody's guess. The pattern in the past, which is already being replicated to some extent, is that the Israelis and or the United States find intermediaries, usually Egypt, to negotiate on their behalf with Hamas to fashion a ceasefire that leaves everybody feeling that they got whatever they were going to get out of the latest round. And then things quiet down for a while. This is a little bit different. The situation is a little bit different for a couple of reasons. One is the fact that what Hamas did in Israel was so horrific. That's a bit of a game changer in terms of Israeli perceptions and that of the international community, because the Hamas fighters who came over the wire to attack Israelis committed some terrible atrocities, many, many terrible atrocities. So that's shaping the psychological environment. But secondly, there are those hostages. There are maybe 150 hostages, possibly more, being held by Hamas in Gaza. And this is going to inject a little bit of uncertainty, I think, into Israeli planning for a campaign against Gaza, because they need to think through the danger to the hostages and whether or not the circumstances call for sacrifice of the hostages in order to pursue more important objectives. And those would include the destruction of the Hamas leadership and the leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
We have been talking with Stephen Simon, who is a senior research analyst at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Also, he is author of the book, Grand Delusion, The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. And Stephen, tell us a little bit about the Quincy Institute. What does the Institute do, and what is your website?
If your listeners just Google me, they'll find quite a few publications in addition to the book that you just so kindly mentioned. On the Quincy Institute, it's a new think tank. It's got one chief objective, which is to press restraint in the formation and implementation of U.S. foreign policy.
Stephen Simon, Senior Research Analyst at the Quincy Institute. Stephen, thank you for taking time to be with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a lot of political developments this week nationwide and in several specific states. We're going to talk about them. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thanks.
Arizona, Scott, is always an interesting state politically. Major development in the U.S. Senate race in Arizona. Give us some details, please.
Well, in 2022, Kari Lake lost a very, very close race for governor of Arizona. And she sort of kicked the tires on running for the United States Senate in a seat that's quite complicated this cycle because Kyrsten Sinema is the incumbent senator. She was a Democrat for a long time, and earlier this cycle, she changed her party affiliation to independent. And even though she continues to caucus with the Democrats, what that created was a three-way race because Congressman Ruben Gallego has also announced his candidacy for the U.S. Senate as a Democrat. So you'll have a Democrat, an independent, and a very strong Republican candidate, Kari Lake, who was really on the TV screen for Arizonans for many, many years, several decades, and she's very well known. You can't get free-earned media better than that unless you're somebody like Donald Trump. So Kari Lake's entrance into this race is a top-tier candidate. She'll certainly be the Republican nominee. President Trump has come out in full force in endorsing her in that race. And so what I think is when you've got some of these McCain voters that might go for Kyrsten Sinema, but then you've got a lot of Democrats that are going to go for Gallego, even though Kyrsten Sinema has been a Democrat, that creates that lane that a Republican can win a close race in 2024. And obviously, Arizona continues to be a toss-up state in the presidential political landscape.
Speaking of the presidential political landscape and third-party candidates, we have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here, Scott, entering the presidential race now, saying he's going to run as an independent or a third-party candidate. What's your take on that?
Kennedy's been out there for several months giving this idea that he was going to run as a Democrat. President Biden and the Secret Service denied his request to get protection. I think that's really frustrated him. He's running sort of in a different lane than President Biden. Obviously, you have to when you're running against the Democrat president incumbent. Nonetheless, the Kennedy family and the Kennedy name is something that I think is one of the most well-known families in American history. So his entrance into the race as an independent candidate and the fact that he's raised, I think, over $14 million in just a couple of days as an independent shows that he's going to have real credibility as an independent candidate for the first time, probably since Ross Perot. When you look back into presidential politics, we had a big Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader, that ran a couple of times, and he chipped off 2-3% in a lot of these states and nationally in the polls. But ultimately, look at the results of 2020, look at the results of 2016. When these races are incredibly close, just a few votes can tip the scale. And so who does Robert Kennedy Jr. pull more, Democrats or the Republicans? He's sort of this medical freedom type candidate that's been out there hammering the Biden administration on their approach to COVID. And there's some folks that say, well, the conventional wisdom there is that he'll pull Republican support away from people that don't like the Republican nominee. I think that that's a little short-sighted. Obviously, in politics, we have a little bit of a saying that partisanship is stronger than nicotine. And the reality is that most voters come back to the Republican base or the Democratic base when it's time to cast their ballot on Election Day or if they're doing early voting because they view it as a two-party system on who can actually win. Nonetheless, you always have protest votes. What does that mean in these close states like North Carolina and Michigan and your state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania? What does it mean in places like Virginia and Arizona and Nevada, Wisconsin? Florida, I think, is a red state at this point. So is Ohio. I don't think that those will really be impacted by a third-party nominee. But when you get to the electoral map and really hitting the magic number to become the president of the United States, I think that a third-party candidacy from Kennedy can certainly swing one direction or the other. And it's going to be something that I think a lot of people start to pay attention to over the next several months as we get into the nominating process, beginning with the Iowa caucuses in early 2024.
And before we get to all of that, we do have several states around the country, Scott, that have very critical legislative elections this year, particularly your home state, Virginia. What do you make of those races? Are they any sort of a bellwether?
Well, we hope so here in Virginia. Governor Youngkin has invested millions of dollars into the Republican Party of Virginia and also through Secure Your Vote Virginia, that's encouraging early voting to everybody within the Republican landscape. We've got some very, very tight state Senate races. We need to win four of those in order to flip the state Senate. I think that everybody kind of considers there to be five incredibly close Senate races. And then we also have to hold the House of Delegates in Virginia. It's a big, big effort. This week, the Republican Party of Virginia asked the Republican National Committee to help with financial assistance. And so what you have here is just going to be an incredibly competitive election. You know that the state Senate is sort of the firewall against Glenn Youngkin and the ability for him to carry out his important agenda for all Virginians. And so it's something I'm trying to help with here, ensuring that we can have victory on November 7th.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as we usually do, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We are united in the ideas of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. Everybody can go to clubforgrowth.org, see more about the candidates that we support, and you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Congress is facing a fiscal mess with an extended budget deadline once again approaching. To discuss what must be done to get the budget under control, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Veronique Darugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eric?
If you're annoyed that inflation is still running as high as it is, my guest today says that you've got to look at fiscal policy and spending restraint in Washington. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique Darugi. She is the chairman of political economics at the Mercatus Center. That's a think tank at George Mason University, and she's a friend of the show. She's been here several times before, and we welcome her back for a few minutes now. Vero, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This news got buried this week under obviously some major geopolitical things that are happening, but we have the final deficit numbers for the fiscal year that ended at the end of September. The country ran a $1.7 trillion deficit. It's really more like a $2 trillion deficit once you do some adjustments for the student loan forgiveness stuff that isn't included in the main calculation there. Regardless of which number you pick, the deficit has jumped significantly from where it was a year ago, and it looks like it's going to continue climbing in the future. This trajectory is, for all the things Joe Biden said about bringing the deficit down during his first year in office, the trajectory is now decidedly in the other direction.
And the thing that's kind of interesting is, like, it's not just what these numbers reveal is that it's not just that actually the deficit is going up compared to what the deficit projection were like when President Biden took office, but it's also literally, it's gone up quite dramatically in the last year. That's what CBO numbers are showing. It's like it's significantly higher than what it was projected in 2021, but also in 2022.
Yeah, the projections were kind of overly rosy to begin with, and now we're exceeding even those. One of the things that's driving all of this, and I mean, we could talk about Social Security and Medicare all day. I mean, those are kind of the big drivers here of the debt. But then the kind of secret thing here is the interest payments on the debt, paying basically our annual credit card bill on the money that we've already borrowed. There's $33 trillion now that has been borrowed, and we're borrowing at a rate of $1 to $2 trillion a year, so we keep adding to it. As that pile of debt gets bigger, and as interest rates have shot up, like, that's really changing the calculus on some of these decisions.
Well, I wish it would change the calculus on these decisions, but it doesn't actually seem to be shaking Congress into actually really talking about fiscal reforms. Your listeners may not know, because most people don't know, that a third of our debt has a maturity of less than a year, and 52% of our debt has a maturity of 3 years or less. So it means that actually a majority of our debt is financed in a very short-term basis. And the reason why this matters is because interest rates, as you said, are like going up quite dramatically. And so it's not just that in the last few years, we've borrowed a lot of money at a lower rate that is now coming due and creating interest payments that are just quite dramatic, but it's also because we've spent literally the last 20 years borrowing a lot of money, and even more than we would have had under the presumption that interest rates would never go up.
I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, I guess, but it's a little bit like, I think most people assume the national debt works a little bit like their mortgage, where you have a locked-in rate, and even if I have a low mortgage rate, because I bought a house a few years ago, interest rates have gone up, that doesn't affect me. The federal government doesn't have that luxury. When interest rates go up, the debt becomes a lot more expensive, and that's what we're seeing now.
No. So the idea, right, was of rolling that debt is like you take advantage of those low rates, and that's great as long as the low rates stay low. But when they don't stay low, right, you're in a bind.
Yeah, that's exactly where we are now. We're talking with Veronique DeRuggi from the Mercatus Center, talking about kind of the state of fiscal policy in the U.S. It's a bit of a mess at the moment. It has been for a while, Vero. This is something we were talking about before we came on air here about how basically after a period of borrowing, there's always an assumption of fiscal tightening, of restraint in future spending, of having to basically pay for all of the dessert that you just ate. Tell us a little bit about that here in the final minute that we have, because I think that's been lost, I think, in this recent phase of massive amounts of borrowing, massive amounts of spending coming out of the pandemic. The other half of that equation has just been gone.
Yes. And I won't bore you with the actual economic and central bank models. But what I will say is that your listeners can just think back of the debates we were having right after the financial crisis, right? Deficits had gone up to $1.5 trillion, which seems like baby deficits now when we think about it. And President Obama was saying, the deficits will come down when we're out of the emergency, signaling that something was going to be done. And sure enough, after the financial crisis, we had all these talks about austerity, how we should do it, should we do it just spending or spending in taxes? And the information is that it should be actually a fiscal adjustment done mostly on spending. That's the way you really truly get a reduction of your debt to deficit level. And this time around, there's none of that. There's literally no one is talking about austerity. No one is talking about we had to spend. So, I mean, the president says he's cutting the deficit, but it's just obviously not true because, as we said, the deficit's going up. And that no one is having a national conversation about, okay, how does austerity come about? That problem of our debt that we're accumulating without ever considering cutting spending or raising taxes could be taken care of with more inflation in the future. And so what happens is like expectation of future inflation becomes inflation today.
Yeah, and if we don't get this under control via fiscal policy, if there isn't some tightening, then you're just going to continue to see inflation rise because we've got to deal with that one way or another. The inflation is one way of dealing with the problem. It would be better if we had this conversation, a conversation that's really not happening right now, as you said, in Washington, but we desperately need to have it. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Veronique DeRuggi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Veronique DeRuggi. She's the chairman of political economics at the Mercatus Center. Check out her work online at mercatus.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out everything we're covering this week around the country and around the world as well at reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Collegiate women's volleyball is growing rapidly in popularity. And a big fan is Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. He talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Eating alone at a Bennigan's restaurant in Steubenville, Ohio, I couldn't stop watching a sports event on one of the TV screens. Of course, that's not unusual for me, but what was unusual is that on this night, I was focused on a women's volleyball match between number 4 ranked Nebraska and number 5 ranked Stanford. And if you think that my interest in women's volleyball was odd, then you need to know about what happened in Lincoln, Nebraska. On August 30th, a gigantic crowd of 92,003 paid attendees, 92,003, to repeat, filled the Nebraska Cornhusker Stadium to cheer the university's five-time NCAA champion women's volleyball team. The huge attendance, at levels theretofore experienced only by the university's storied football program, broke the all-time world record for a women's sporting event. Think about that, over 92,000 for volleyball. Those are crowd sizes you see only with some NCAA football teams, Big Ten programs like Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan. For 92,000 to show up in the heart of Midwest corn country for women's volleyball is staggering. Most important, what happened in Nebraska genuinely reflects legitimate interest in the sport. And that's what most impresses me about the success of women's college volleyball nationwide. It's authentic. The popularity is real. It's not contrived. The games are broadcast increasingly in one of the ESPN channels, and people are tuning in. By contrast, politically correct promoters at ESPN and the other sports networks for years have pushed women's pro basketball on viewers to little avail. And I say that while happily acknowledging the outstanding women hoopsters who can literally run circles around some guys in a basketball game. But generally speaking, let's admit it, men and women alike will not throng stadiums to watch women play basketball, and certainly not to watch women toss footballs. And yes, there are women's football leagues. But rejoice, ESPN and feminist fighters for women's athletics. You have a winner in women's volleyball, and count me among the fans. I first watched a women's volleyball match at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where I'm a professor. It was by accident. I was beating around campus on a Saturday afternoon with my kids when we happened upon a game in the arena. We sat down and watched. Wow, I said to my kids, these girls are really good. Years later, I picked up again when my alma mater, the University of Pittsburgh, had the top women's team in the country. I was blown away by the skill level. These women are immensely talented at a high level, the digs, the serves, the spikes, kills, the setups. But I think what also resonates with fans is that volleyball seems a natural fit for women. It's so unlike the grotesque spectacle of women punching each other in the face in female boxing or mixed martial arts. Women's volleyball seems the best extension of femininity. The girls have long hair, ponytails, hair ties, earrings, lipstick, makeup. Frankly, they're pretty, while also strong. And the femininity is further displayed in how these volleyball players react to one another. They do group hugs when they score every point, and there's a lot of points in best of five matches. It's not like a soccer game. They console crying opponents after a loss. Unlike guy hockey or football players, they don't knock senseless and brood over victims, laying in agony, groaning at their feet. They're compassionate, even while drilling the ball over the net. They care for each other. I read the lips of one female volleyball player who said to another after a bad setup, "Are you okay?" "Yes," she said, "I'm fine." In all, these character traits have allowed college women to carve out a niche for themselves. They own volleyball. Here's a sport where male counterparts aren't even on the radar. To be sure, I'm personally not such a fan that I'll start checking the schedule to tune in on a regular basis, as I would for, say, the NFL or NCAA football, but many people will. Many are doing that. In fact, just ask the folks in Nebraska. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTRU-FM in La Harpe, Kansas, along with WENG-AM and FM in Englewood, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.